So welcome in this episode, where we are having a guest called Mattia Chukulier. I hope I pronounced that correctly.
It was close enough. You could just drop the J. So Mattia Chukulier is how you probably pronounce it. But
So now I have the recording, so I can cut out this bit and practice.
And just... Right.
But I do the editing.
Oh, shit. Okay. So, a bit of background. Who are you?
So, as you said, my name's Mattia Chukulier. Some people still call me Hook. That was or still is my nickname online in a lot of places. Usually when I introduce myself to people, I just say I'm a lawyer by profession and a hacker by heart. I think you know me long enough that that probably sounds okay, right?
It depends on how... you've been a lawyer for a while now.
Well,
so I think for every year you become more of a lawyer.
True, yeah. I've been more involved with lawyery stuff recently, but still, I mean, in the... It even now, it still happens at work. It still happens. Like after 3 years at life, some people still think that I'm from part of engineering, not a very capable part of engineering, but it happens. It happens that people say, "Oh, I thought you're one of the engineers." Yeah, no, I'm the lawyer.
But you have spent quite a bit in the various communities, have you?
Yeah. It started way back in, I don't know, 96, 97, 98, somewhere around 97, when I started using Linux in high school. So there was this one box in the computer part of the library, which, well, you know, everything else was, I think it was Windows 95 or maybe already 98, and like really slow machines, like on dual ISDN line. So, you know, loading up your Yahoo mail took like forever. So you know, by the time the break was over, you could see you had new mail, but then you had to log off. So, you know, little use was that. And, you know, in the middle of it, there was like this black box, you know, black screen, just text, white text on black screen. I was intrigued. So, I started playing with that. Or, you know, I asked somebody what's that about? And then they got me access. That's where my nickname comes from. I had to get a user account, so I had to have a username to log in. And at that time, I was very much into pirates, like real pirates. And I just recently learned from the Encyclopedia Britannica that, like, the physical version, like, we're still talking about the 90s, that was a thing. That Captain Hook and Captain Silver were real people. And I found that pretty cool. So I just used Hook as a nickname, and it stuck. So through that, I got into contact with the Linux User Group of Slovenia, and read about, you know, the early open source essays from Stallman and ESR, and I got interested in the whole community thing because that sounded cool. And through that, I got involved with the Kyberpipa or Cyberpipe hackerspace. Had a short stint, I think like for a year, or was it less? I think for a year, I worked for the Government Center for Informatics on open source and open standards work group. That was in 2003, I think, something along those lines. And then eventually I got in contact with FSFE and was volunteering. And at some point, Karsten Gerloff, who was then president of FSFE, to my big surprise, offered me the position of a paid member, so of staff as the legal coordinator of FSFE. And that's the short version of the big communities I was involved with. And you know, then being active in whichever distro I currently used, active a tiny bit with KDE, and things like that.
You're still in KDE, aren't you?
Yeah, I think I'm part of the EV. I'm not sure. I think I'm an EV member. And yeah, just recently we had a discussion about licensing. But yeah, basically, I usually, when it comes to licensing and stuff like that, I speak my mind, and then they obviously do what they think is best. But
it's good to have you in KDE, because I mean the situation has been complicated. I think it's a lot clearer these days than back in the 90s.
Oh wow, yeah. Jesus, Trolltech, eh?
Yeah.
That was fun times.
It was. It actually was.
It's much more clear now. There is no problems at all, or
I mean, I don't think I'm allowed to comment on this.
No,
I don't.
So let's
I don't.
Leave that.
And also, I don't know nearly enough to comment on it. Even if I thought it would be fair to comment, I don't know enough. I'm not involved as much to comment on that.
But I mean, as a user of the Qt libraries or the KDE frameworks, then it's clear.
The
complications is more on other sides.
Yeah. It's the always contentious situation where you have the intersection of community and business, and we see that like everywhere. That's, you know, that's not a KDE specific. It's just that KDE was maybe one of the first ones where it became apparent.
We actually have a talk from Aid
on
that topic, so we can just link to it up in the corner here.
Oh, cool. I binged through most of these, so I'm almost at the end, but I'm still of your podcast, but I'm still missing a few.
Then you have 5 years of conference talks.
Yeah, not just the podcast. I mean, what I think it just did the last since it started as a podcast. I didn't do all the videos though.
So I'm a bit interested in the your profession or the lawyer. So what did you specialize in?
We don't have like on my university in Ljubljana, university, there is no specification, specialization in when you go to law school, at least on my faculty. So my specialization, literally, it says law. But in practice, yeah, I specialized in intellectual property law and tiny bit business law. So the thing is, we have in the last 2 years, we have, and especially in the last year, you can choose which courses you want to take. And I took like all of the intellectual property courses that were available, and some international business courses and stuff like that. For some reason, I found it interesting. Also, transport law. That kind of interests me. I no capacity to comment on anything, yet alone do anything when it comes to transport law. But it's an interesting field.
I know nothing. at least I know that. So what's most fun with being like a lawyer?
I'm going to spin this one a bit around, because I mean, even the fact that you guys are talking to me means that I'm not, you know, your typical run of the mill lawyer who has their own law firm and does, you know, everything under the sun. So I very much in practice specialize in open source licensing and licensing in general. But what got me into law and through the many long years I took to finally finish that study. Hesse is Henrik is laughing because he was vice president when I was still working at FSFE, so he knows how long it took.
We try to encourage you quite often.
You did, you did.
So when I left, you finally did it. So I get the point. Yeah, sorry for interrupting you.
So what got me into it is what I think is interesting is that law is always like has this almost bipolar or this complex interaction with the real world, where on one hand, it has to reflect reality, because otherwise, as I think Jelinek says, it becomes unlaw and therefore should be abandoned. So if law does not reflect the reality, it's useless, or sometimes even worse. But on the other hand, it also forms it. So we see, like, especially in the modern times, a typical law that we can, like, every one of us feels that is changing the world around us is GDPR. And it hasn't changed only Europe. I mean, the idea got exported across borders, like, to other continents as well. So we have, like, this is what I find really interesting about law is because it, on one hand, it codifies what reality is or what reality should be, but at the same end, it also influences. So it's like an interesting balancing act. The other thing why why I always thought I'm not gonna be like I was always pretty sure, or pretty early on during my studies, I was pretty sure I'm not gonna end up as a typical lawyer, as an advocate with their own office and represent like everything that's under the sun. Is not because I don't like it. I think that's a really interesting challenge, but I feel like if you really want to be good at something, you have to understand the field you're in. So, for example, like if even if you look at, for example, if you look at an architect, when you get an architect to create something, you do expect them to understand basic statics and basic physics of how things stand up. And I think the same should apply also to lawyers. So when you're getting a lawyer to look into your code or your intellectual property rights of software, they need to understand how software works, because otherwise, I mean, you can be just spewing, quoting laws left and right, but that thing doesn't apply. And we come back to the interesting interconnection of law and reality, right? I mean, the reality is, or physics and mathematics is the law of is, the world of is, and with law you're in the world of should, but if should and is not nearly connected, you get into really weird situations.
Cool. That kind of like relates to the idea that if you look at a lawyer, it's good to have a lawyer who understands the techie part, and it's good to have like developers who understands at least some of the developers who understands some of the legal parts.
Yep, definitely.
I mean, it's kind of interesting to compare the two fields, I'd say, because my experience as an engineer is that law is often written, if you read law as code, it doesn't work. So
Yeah,
you
no.
need to read law as a purpose, so to speak, what's meant, which
To
is
be a,
sometimes challenging as an engineer.
it, I have a good analogy. It's like you can read law as, it's not a super analogy, but it's at least can get you thinking in the right direction. It's like you can read law as written law, you can read as source code. But the way how it applies in the end is, you know, once you build it, once it gets through the linker and the compiler, and it very much depends on the environment you build it in, you're going to get a different outcome depending on which machine you build it on. So you know, I would say like that's a comparison.
It makes sense. And I mean, as then a software engineer, it's hard to see the environment because we don't know that field. So I think it's, yep.
Right, that's the tricky bit. That's why I need a lawyer, is because they understand the environment and can predict, you know, how the linker and the compiler kind of work.
Yep.
And it's the same with engineers. It's like, you know, when you're writing software, you know, most of the time you don't know what the, you know, if you just write the source code, you don't know what the environment and what the linker, especially the linker and then the compiler, are going to do. You can predict stuff, but you never know for sure until you test it out in the real world environment.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's the biggest difference switching from community to a company? Because you are working as a let's go to your profession or your day-to-day work later. But what's the biggest difference?
The biggest difference, I mean, I think like the first thing that blew my mind was there's budget. But for example, like I've been working for Liferay for 3 years. I'm now in the position of senior counsel. And everybody was so surprised when I applied, said, oh, you know, slowly I really need a, you know, an external monitor for my setup. And everybody was like, what? You don't have an external monitor yet? I was like, yeah, no, I mean, I've used my 13-inch ThinkPad before. Everything was fine, but now you guys are using this huge table. And even on the 14-inch Dell, it's just too big. And they were like, but everybody gets, you know, everybody that works from home gets a monitor right away. It was like, yeah. I didn't think that was in the budget. It's like, what, you crazy? Of course it's in the budget. You need the monitor. But on the other hand, I mean, the Liferay is really frugal about its money. So it's not, I haven't flew in business class yet. Let's just say like that, even to the America. But it's interesting, like you get a budget. There's one thing that's, but I find, like, on the other hand, what I find interesting is like with NGOs, you tend to be, you know, you have to be very nimble when you do things. You know, you have limited resources and you try to squeeze out as much as you can with it. I mean, it's the same in a company, but, you know, in our company, there's like roughly around 1,000 employees around the world, and it gets really complicated really fast. So it's also like the organization graph is like much more spread out, and then finding the one person that's responsible for the specific thing you need to figure out is sometimes a bit tricky. But on the other hand, what's also kind of useful is because these people are paid to do their job, you actually have leverage. Whereas when you're dealing with, you know, volunteers, you can't force them. I mean, you can try to force them, but they're always, you know, completely free to just go away. And there's like nothing keeping them other than, you know, they're just wanting to stay. So you need to keep them, you need other means to keep them happy other than money.
I mean, isn't one of the big difference between an NGO and sort of a for-profit company with a mission that for an NGO, you're trying to squeeze out as much as possible from the money you have to achieve something good, while for a company, you try to squeeze out as much as possible to actually get more. I mean, the direction is towards profits. It makes it easier to spend because it's an investment, basically.
I mean, it's here is again, like, library is a bit specific, I guess, in this case, because we're still privately owned by the founders, and there is no plans to change that. So they were not, you know, looking for a NPO. IPO. We're not going public anytime soon or at all. And the other thing is, like, that because the company started as an, like, the company really started as an open source project that was initially intended to be a web portal or CMS for the local church. So, and then they figured out that it's too complicated for the church to run.
Let's so set they up started... a 1,000-man company instead.
So they eventually created the company around it. And what they still do, I think they donate 10% or dedicate 10% of the profits every year to charities or charitable things. So they even send, like, each of us employees gets 40 hours of paid time to work on a charity, and we get a budget, I think, of 500 euros to also to donate to a charity of our choosing every year. So they're not, of course, Liferay is a company. Of course, you know, the accumulation of money is a, you know, thing, and growth and everything. But it's not as crazy as, you know, it would be in any startup. Or any privately or publicly owned company where you need to please the shareholders. So there's no shareholders to please. So
how does the day, working day look like for you? What is it you do?
What is it I do? Well, I'm happily, and I hope nobody hears that from the company, I'm happily still in the position where I'm mostly able to look for my own work. So I'm, you know, the title is senior counsel for the IP tracks, for the intellectual property. So on paper, I'm responsible for all intellectual property flowing in and flowing out of the company. Apart from trademarks, a colleague of mine, Kirsten Hunyar, is responsible for trademarks. I'm happy to say she's doing a great job at that. And I haven't done much with trademarks before, so I'm really happy somebody else is dealing with that. So, you know, because it's code, it mostly means copyright and occasionally patents, more in the sense of figuring out what's the best patent protection scheme we can use. So on a day-to-day basis, I log in, I check my email, I check Jira for any inbound or outbound licensing issues that get assigned to me, because I'm the only one in the open source licensing team. So I don't have anybody else to work with me on that. I still have to do all the scanning of the source code myself, and the legal decisions on which licenses are okay in which situations and which not. So that's basically it. And so when I don't have to scan inbound components or our own outbound products and projects, I try to, you know, tweak things here and there. So recently, a few months ago, we simplified our CLA signing process, which was a joint project by the developer relations team and me. So we worked on that and simplified it. So, you know, things like that. You look around, see where you can optimize things, see where, you know, open up cupboards, find skeletons, note them down, I'm happy to report that the list is getting smaller. You know, as you can imagine, for the first year or two, the list was continuously getting longer, you know, when you poke around and you find things.
No shit. You know.
I think both of you can relate to this situation.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But you actually touched on two interesting topics there in your replies. I mean, we spoke with Mirko Böhm around Software Panted a while ago, and we've also had Katarina Maracke for CLAs. So can we dive into one of those? What was the simplification about, for instance? How are you working with CLAs?
CLAs. I mean, you might know that's a bit of a pet project of mine or pet peeve of mine, CLAs. I actually wrote my master thesis on the fiduciary license agreement. And I'm working with Katarina on the current version of the FLA and the contribute to agreements.org.
I think, just as an explanation, most people of our listeners are probably aware of what CLA is, but can you describe briefly what an FLA is?
FLA is basically a very specific CLA. So it's like you have Apache CLA and you have all sorts of different custom CLAs. So the FLA is a CLA that the FSFE created many years ago. And the big difference is that the FLA strikes a really interesting balance where not only are you... So on one hand, the contributor gives an exclusive all the exclusive rights to their code to the entity, to the fiduciary, but on the other hand, the fiduciary is obligated by the FLA that if they're going to use the contribution, it has to be included also in an open source version. So it has to be released under an open source license. It does allow for dual licensing, so it does, because you do get exclusive rights. The fiduciary can have a closed source version, but it also needs to be in an open source version. And it also gives back all the rights to the contributor, so obviously non-exclusive rights, but that means that other than, you know, from legal speak, but the mere exclusivity, the contributor doesn't lose any of the rights in the code that they contribute. They can still do with the code that they sent whatever they want. They contribute it to a different project. They can even use it in their own proprietary product if they want to. So that's the main difference between the FLA and most other CLAs out there. It's like this balance between the two. So you also make the fiduciary accountable. And the other thing is, like, there are a few safeguards in there. And the biggest one is that if the fiduciary breaks the trust, that the FLA automatically cancels the assignment, so the exclusive rights assignment to the fiduciary. So the contributor automatically gets all the rights back as if nothing happened before.
I think I interrupted you asking you to explain FLA, and I kind of forgot where we were before that. You were explaining your work with the CLA and FLA at your company.
Yeah. So, I mean, when it comes to the company, it's because we're a dual licensing or to some extent open core, but the core is like huge, massive. So the proprietary version is like really, really tiny difference. And, you know, as of a few months ago, or maybe it's also a whole year, but quite a few months ago, you can also get the source code to the proprietary version in the same sense as you do with Elastic. So the source code, the proprietary bits are licensed as a proprietary, as under a proprietary license in its own folder, but you get access to the whole source code. But because we have that proprietary component, and because we do have customers that ask for a proprietary license, so they don't want to use the open source version, we have to have the source, we have to have the copyright assigned to us, or at least have an exclusive right in it. So we did, like, I didn't create the CLA we're using or the contributor agreement we are using. But I just inherited it. I have my own thoughts on it privately. but at least what we could do is we had like a really complicated process of how you sign it. So when you contributed code to our main repository, there was like, you had to create a Jira account on our own server and then create a ticket and then, you know, check the box that you read the CLA, the contributor agreement in that ticket, and then open a GitHub pull request, refer that ticket. So we got rid of the...
And this really motivated a lot of
computers. Yeah, of course, that was a huge motivator, right? So we got rid of the Jira step. So we set up a CLA assistant bot, and all community contributions can now go directly to the appropriate GitHub repositories. And, you know, the bot will just say, okay, is has that person already read and signed the, you know, checked that they signed the contributor agreement? Yes, okay, pass. If not, well, you need to do that before you can, you know, before it gets merged. So it's still there. What the future will bring when it comes to our contributor agreements, we'll see. I'm always on the quest to simplify things and make things easier for contributors. But, you know, yes, there are limitations of how far you can push it.
So we had another interesting topic there next to CLA. So you spoke about patents and you, how you work around patents. I guess it's about not tripping over patents, or what's the challenge you're trying to solve?
I mean, we're not super concerned about patents. So we've been a member of OIN of Open Invention Network for quite a bit already. So the only what I'm looking for is whether we can, you know, is whether there's another scheme that would complement it. And so far it seems, because it does, like, OIN only covers the what falls under the Linux definition, and it also does that as long as it's in there, right? So we're thinking of looking into other options to expand our coverage. So right now it seems like we're talking with LotNet, which is more of a anti-troll scheme, where, you know, all the members, as soon as they keep the patents, but and the patent rights, but as soon as, if I remember correctly, it's been a long time since I read it, but as soon as you transfer a patent to a non-practicing entity, everybody in the pool will automatically, or everybody that's a member of LotNet automatically gets a patent license to that patent. So protecting you from the potential troll, right? So I think that's what the next step will be for us, as to join that as well. We're still, you know, looking into it, but that might be an interesting thing for people to look into as well. There was another similar network to LotNet, which I think was more favorable, which had some favorable coverage by financial newspapers, but I think that one pretty much petered out. I think it didn't get any traction in the end. I mean, it had some big names initially, but I think like then it kind of just stopped. So I think like LotNet is OIN plus LotNet sounds like a good combination to me right now.
So it's basically about protecting yourself around about the risk of software patents by pooling up in strategic groups.
Yeah, that plus, I mean, when you scan source code, sometimes you find interesting things. So recently, I had to scan ImageMagick and GhostScript.
Mm-hmm.
I won't spoil anything. You guys have fun. No, it's not that bad. It's not that bad, but
it's always fun to talk with other people who do checkups. So there are some favorite packages everyone has. I certainly have mine.
Yeah, Zlib is up there as well. It's also included, I think, in the package that I looked, in the GhostScript package that I looked, it had a few Zlib files, and it notoriously had the Che Guevara Zlib header. Hmm. Have you found that one yet?
I've heard about it. But it's not a show about me, so. So on that, like scanning and seeing strange stuff, you and I have like similar jobs. But I'm not a lawyer. But what is the most?
And I'm not a coder, so that's fair.
So what's the most common question you get from your developer colleagues?
I mean, I assembled an FAQ and a very, very, very long licensing policy. So I created it in a way that it's, you know, kind of like follow your adventure kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So you have like a table of pre-approved licenses for code, pre-approved licenses for fonts, pre-approved licenses for other content, and then also, you know, not allowed licenses and licenses where you should totally ask legal for approval on every specific use case. And then you click through those and you get like short summaries and what you need to do to fulfill the obligations. So I get less of them now, and there's an FAQ I have internal as well. It took me like 2 years to set up that. But like, I would say what's interesting is like, I think in the company, I get different questions from engineers than I did when I was still working for FSFE from, you know, community questions. Mm-hmm. So like in, as I said, I mean, in a company, you have this, you know, more or less rigid structure. So you kind of know who's responsible for what. So typically what happens is I just get a ticket and it says, okay, we want to use component X in product Y. Can we do that? You know, that's the most common question I get nowadays. Mm. Whereas with the community, you got like some really interesting questions, like on a more of a, you know, a higher level, like a more abstract level, questions. Like, my favorite weird one was that if I don't put any license in there, there's no copyright attached, right? I mean, then it's public domain. Mm. It's like, oh God, no. Mm. The other way around. It's the other way around. Abort, abort. But what are more abstract questions that I get from internally?
Copying code from Stack Overflow?
Oh, Christ. Yeah, there was one question like that. Yeah. I'm not going to share my answer publicly. I also deny getting this question.
Mm-hmm. Okay. this, we're running out of time. So A final question. Rumors are saying that you've been having Swedish surströmming.
Oh God, yeah.
And as an explanation, what do you call that? It's herring that you
When
ferment.
instead of pickling it, you ferment it.
Yeah,
It gives
it's
a bit
fermented.
more bite.
Yeah.
It's not that
No
bad.
comments.
I mean,
Okay.
I thought it's gonna be worse. I mean, the smell is awful, and the
Yeah,
bile
the
in
smell
there is
is.
all the bile is the problematic part, but the fish itself is not that bad.
Okay.
I mean,
I never eat it.
I wrote a blog post about it. I think that's how you found out about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
I do prepare, actually.
I don't. Ah, you stalk. No, I did. I did. I actually didn't find it that. The biggest problem was getting it on the airplane. So the.
Oh, imagine that one exploding.
Exactly. So the luck I had was that I actually had, you know, to smuggling it back home was the big challenge from Malmo. So what I did, I had to run through like three different counters to get it cleared by several people on the airport. And then eventually they said, okay, so if the airline is going to be okay with having it on board, and we know that many airlines don't, but if the airline's going to be okay, we're okay with shipping it to them. I said, okay. So we went to the counter and I flew with, you know, by then it still existed, so now it's defunct, Adria Airways, so the Slovenian national carrier. And you know, the lady behind the counter was Swedish, right? But she was like responsible for the many other small companies. And she said, yeah, I mean, Adria doesn't know this thing exists. There's no rules against it, so so go for it. It's like, okay. And if it's gonna explode, you're gonna notice. It's like, okay.
But it's one of them things. I've had some strange dishes around the world where it's like things you eat because you have to. You probably found some fermented herring and you had to eat it, and all of a sudden the tourist office in some country decided that this is all of a sudden a delicacy,
Yeah,
but it's
yeah.
not. I think I had rotten shark in Iceland, and I can honestly say it wasn't good.
I heard about that one. Yeah, I heard about that one. I think that's one I'm actually more afraid of than surströmming. I think the rotten shark sounds really bad. But so
It's
far,
like
so.
eating ink.
Sorry?
Horrible. It was
Yeah.
like eating ink.
Yeah. So far, the worst, you know, the worst one I had so far was Korean bloodwurst. Because we have bloodwurst in Slovenia. It's like, you know, you put it into intestine and there's like pig's blood with mixed with rice, or sometimes we use barley or even buckwheat, and, you know, marjoram and spices and stuff like that. It's a nice thing, right? So it's closer to the UK black pudding ish, like kind of like that, what we do in Slovenia. But and for some reason, what they do in and we bake them. So, you know, you get a crust and it's like you know, it's not chewy, it's crunchy on the outside. But for some reason, what they do in Korea is they boil them. Or steam them. I think they steam them, and they even fill them instead of with rice. They fill them with really, really thick, like, you know, 1 centimeter thick square rice noodles. And they're still intestines. So, but you know, it's steamed, so it's chewy as hell.
Oh God.
And I was like,
Oh.
I like blood sausage, but that was like, oh my God, this is not going anywhere. And then I had a French colleague of mine who said he was in Korea as well. And apparently, I was at a posh restaurant because sometimes they don't clean the thing so thoroughly.
Should we leave it hanging there?
Let's leave it at that.
God. I think we should end the entire session here.
Well, it was great having you on the show.
Cut.
Abandon the ship. Abandon the ship. Yeah.
Thank you for joining. And yeah, we hope you catch up so that you finally get to hear your own episode.
Hey, thanks for being here. Me. And I hope at some point I managed to join you guys in person as well. I mean, FOSS North was on my to-do list for quite some time, but it just never happened.